So thank you very much. We have just set up a new lab in Milan. So if you want to come to visit us, and also we have each year 3 PhD positions plus a permanent position which will be filled in the near future. So something's going on. So I would like to take advantage of the tutorial we heard, very nice tutorial we heard this morning, to try to hopefully have some interaction. Okay, so I would like to reconcile with the tutorial of this morning, find the bridge between statistical physics and what you told us. So more or less, the kind of questions that I would like to address are, you know, how does the energy landscape of feed-forward network look like? Are there dynamical traps? Convergence and generalization, they go together or not? They compete or not? And somehow, which are the unifying aspects of the learning algorithm which are used, okay? And the motivation for this is that we find that wide flat minima in the loss function of neural network exist in the case of random patterns. So the idea that in the basic question is whether this is a useful general property of neural networks. And we have giving, I mean, we believe that the answer is yes, and we have evidence for this. So first of all, briefly, let me mention that discussing what is the energy landscape or the loss landscape of a multilayer neural network is very difficult because you cannot even choose the model. So many things have changed in the last decade or so. So people have changed the loss function. As we will see, choosing the loss function is not irrelevant. So mean square error behaves completely different compared to the cross entropy, for instance. They've changed the transfer function, and again, this is not irrelevant. The learning dynamics has changed. All sorts of regularization techniques and so on have been introduced. The architecture has changed. Now we're using deep network instead of shallow network. And then there are all the preprocessing stages and so forth. So it's very complicated to define what is the model. So the philosophy that we follow is to consider the building block, which is what we discussed this morning. So say this, we call it the pure classifier. So with the pure classifier, I mean this network can have, you know, can be arbitrarily connected, but the neurons are just, the basic units are just threshold linear units. And so the output will be, say, plus if the input is above a certain threshold and minus one if it is below a certain threshold. This is our starting device, and we can compose this device in, you know, in different types of architecture. Okay, so this is more or less where we used to be in the 90s, more or less, right? So the aim of the talk is to discuss what is the energy landscape of this type of networks, and then see how all the changes that I've mentioned to you, how the evolution of these models have affected the energy landscapes. So more or less, the idea is that you start with a scenario like this, in which the loss function looks very ragged and very complicated, and then you add all possible modification to the models, and you end up with something that looks like this, which is, of course, still non-convex, but very, very different from the original one. And the basic idea is that you amplify the role of this rare wide flat minima that have good generalization property and are accessible. I could conclude here, more or less, to talk about. Okay. So let's start with our original model. And let me mention just a very famous result by Elizabeth Gardner, or 87 or so. And what she did is, you know, for the model that I've just introduced before, so for the simple perceptron, she studied the volume, the optimal volume in the weight space for a network storing random patterns. So the idea is that essentially she computed this integral. So the idea is that you integrate over all possible weights that are considered to be real variables here. You impose a spherical constraint just to avoid trivial reparametrizations, okay? And then you want all the patterns to be correctly classified. So you want the input, which is this quantity here, to be have the same say sign of the output. Sorry, this probably is a theta. Sorry, that is not a delta, it's a theta function. Sorry. It's a step function, okay? And so, well, the basic idea here is that in the limit of large n, and the patterns here are just random, independent distributed variables. The issue here is that this quantity is an exponential quantity in n, and so you cannot average it, because the average would be dominated by rare configuration that greatly contributes to the value of this volume. So what you need to do to obtain the most probable value is to take the average of the log, and then the most probable value for the volume will be given by the exponential of the average of the log, okay? So the difficulty comes from computing this average, and this can be done using statistical physics method like the replica method and so on. And what she found essentially is that when you have random patterns, the volume is always convex. The region in the weight space that corresponds to perfect memorization of the random patterns.
So yes.
Case, yeah, case is a robustness parameter, okay, here that you can think k equals zero just for simplicity, okay. Sorry, this is really, okay. Now, if you have zero, the number of patterns is alpha, a parameter times n, so it's proportional to the number of weights you have in your model. And if you have zero patterns, all configurations are fine, so you just integrate this part here. And this would be the initial volume on the hypersphere, and then you start to cut with hyperplanes this volume, and you always have a convex body here. So this is why learning is easy in this problem, as we heard before. This is why you can, you know, the perceptron algorithm works and converges. You have always a convex space, and it's easy to find the minimum. Then there is a critical capacity, alpha is equal to 2 in this case, in which this volume shrinks to 0, and above that it's no longer possible to store patterns. So this is a very old result, okay? So the landscape here doesn't look very interesting, right? Because it's a convex set, okay? And you have no local minimum, and everything is easy, okay? But then one can extend this type of calculation to multilayer networks, which are non-convex. And okay, here I got the theta right. And now things become more complicated. I'll be fast on this because I want to discuss about the new results. But so for multilayer networks, you can again try to compute the volume corresponding to perfect memorization of the patterns. Again, you see this is the input to the output unit, and this is the desired output. When they have the same sign, this is equal to 1, and so it contributes to the integral, otherwise it doesn't contribute. And if you look at this, if you do all the calculation, this is a very old paper, you find that indeed, for when you have few patterns, the volume is connected, whereas above a certain threshold, which is 1.76 for k equals 3, for 3 even units, the volume becomes disconnected into many components, which are far apart. And this starts to look interesting, because if you now try to, with the gradient descent, to find the optimum of this in this region, you will fail. It will not converge to the optimum with just a simple gradient algorithm. Okay. Yeah.
Why not?
Oh, because associated to this, you have an exponential number of minima saddles and so on. So it's a really glassy surface. I mean, this.
Optimization.
Sorry.
Leads to total optimization.
Yeah. I mean, so if you have a dynamics which is just a kind of Langevin dynamics which tends to equilibrate as a stationary state to have the Gibbs measure, then you're going to get stuck.
Just to understand the limit, so the synthetics, you're taking the number of feeding units fixed?
So I take k, the number of hidden units, to be fixed, and then n going to infinity.
The
number of weights in the first layer.
Okay.
So it's an infinite network, but with a finite number of, finite but can be very large. Okay, so this is where things become interesting. Now you can also analyze in more detail what happens in this connected components, and analyze how many internal representation of the data corresponds to each connected component. So you can say a lot of things about these geometrical features, but for time reason, I think I want to skip this. And this is just stochastic gradient failing in finding ground states in the region in which you have this breaking or separation of the regions. So the question is, okay, this is fine. This was known. This was really 2 minutes of a summary of what we knew in the 90s. Is this all what we have to say about the geometry of the space of solution in neural networks? So question mark. Because if this is the case, we have some type of problem. First of all, it's difficult to converge, and it's not clear that generalization is guaranteed by these kind of systems. Okay. So what we believe is that no, this is not the case. So this is not all we have to say. And in fact, I think one of the drawbacks of the theory of the 90s was to ignore some large deviation properties of these landscapes, which are actually crucial for algorithms. Okay, so let me go back to the simplest possible non-convex device, which is a perceptron with binary weights. I'm going to talk about this because Nike is going to give a talk on the rigorous results on the binary perceptron, so I thought I could introduce for you. And also, it has the advantage that it's the simplest object. So the idea is that, so let's start to discuss the landscape of the simplest possible non-convex neural network. We have seen that for the perceptron with continuous weight, everything is convex, and so it's trivial, and I don't want to talk about that. So either we consider multilayer networks, or we consider a perceptron with discretized weights. Okay, and now we'll do both things. So let me start with this one. So you have a perceptron. Now the weights that sit on the links here are plus or minus one. And of course, now the instead of the volume, we will need to compute an entropy. So the number of configuration on the hypercube that correspond to perfect memorization of the pattern. Okay, so the device is always the same, but now the W's are plus or minus one, so we have to count how many configurations correspond to perfect memorization, okay? And of course, one can rewrite this in a statistical physics framework, and so one can write an energy function, which is the number of error that the network makes, which is a sum over all the patterns, mu runs over the patterns, and here you have the theta of minus the desired output times the output of the device. Tau is the output of the device. Okay, so tau, you see, is the output. So whenever these two do not have the same sign, this quantity, when they have the same sign, this quantity is negative, so you don't contribute to the error. Whenever they have different signs, you have a minus here, so you do contribute, you count the number of errors. Okay, so this is a function that counts how many errors the network is making on a given training set. And here, another way of writing this is this one, but it's not very important. Now, we can take this as an energy and take the zero temperature limit and study the Gibbs measure of this energy function in order to understand which are the property of the ground state, so the zero energy states. Okay, this is the standard procedure. So we want to compute this quantity here in the limit of beta going to infinity, okay? So which is going to concentrate on the absolute minima of the energy function, so on the zero error configuration, if they exist, okay? And clearly you see that the partition function in this case here is nothing but the number of solution, okay? And log z is just the entropy. Okay, now I skip all the historical results, I go to more recent results. So what comes out for this problem is very interesting. So if you compute that partition function and compute the entropy, you find that essentially the following results, that for any alpha greater than zero, and then you have an exponential number of configuration of the W's that perfectly memorize the random patterns. And they are point-like and always far apart. So the distance between two configurations that memorize the pattern is order n in Hamming distance. And you have an exponential number of them. And this number shrinks to zero at a critical point, which is 0.83, which was predicted by Kraut and Nezard in 1989. And I think Nike is going to tell us something about rigorous proofs relative to these thresholds here. But what I want to focus on today is that below the critical capacity, so in the region where memorization is possible, if you compute the typical distance between solutions, you find this kind of scenario, which means that essentially the minimum distance between typical solution is always order n in Hamming distance. So they're always far apart. And this is very similar to what happens in an error correcting codes, in which you have, you know, ground states that correspond to different code words that have to be far apart in order to be able to correct errors. Okay, so this is what comes out. Now, clearly, if this is the case, then we are in trouble, because when you have this kind of scenario, you can also show, I mean, with statistical physics method, that you have an exponential number of local minima, and which means that if you try to minimize the energy, you will do some simulated annealing or whatever method you want, you're going to get stuck. And this is an example. So you take a small network, and you see that for alpha equal 0.3, so below the critical capacity, this n equal 800, doesn't matter. And what you see is that you see that the plateau appears when you do the annealing scheme. And if you increase n, this plateau goes up and it becomes longer, and which means that in the limit of large n, you're going to be stuck. And this can be also proven analytically, okay? And so what this is telling us is that if this scenario is all we have to say about this problem, we are not so happy, because it means that with a binary perception, you can essentially, you cannot hope to memorize anything, right? I mean, easily, yeah. Sorry, I didn't.
Bayesian hopping global optimization works quite well for.
Yeah. I get that. But it works well, but it does not find these solutions. It does not find those solutions.
Which one?
I'll tell you in a minute.
So the figures that you have there suggest that not only is the distance or the radius of the solutions order n, but it also really occupies the entire space. So if you look, maybe I'll ask you this way. If we look at the radius of the solutions, the radius of the set including the solutions compared to the total diameter of the entire space.
You mean you want to know which is the size of a dot?
No. I'm looking at, so if you go back to the next slide, so if you look for example at the top right figure there, so I'm looking at the radius of the set including all the red, the radius of all the red points,
yeah,
compared to the radius or diameter of the entire set of solutions compared to, so both order n.
Mm-hmm.
But this implies that they really are the ratio, it's the entire thing. I mean, if you look at the diameter between these two, is it one? Or does it actually, is it some something that doesn't?
No, they are, you mean, you're asking whether they're scattered, say,
Yeah.
No, they're scattered far away. They're scattered on order n distances. Okay. Okay, but the distance is order n between points,
right,
and you have an exponential number of such points, so.
Yeah, so I'm curious about this order n, because when you say order n, I mean, so it doesn't, I'm sure it increases with n, but is it really 1 times n, or is it like some much smaller constant times n that depends on other parameters of the
problem? No, it's order n. So now, just to answer to your observation, it's true that now, this was the situation in the 90s. A lot of people have tried actually to perform learning with this kind of device in the 90s, failing badly by using simulated annealing, genetic algorithm, all this kind of stuff. Why? Well, because these are algorithms that want to that have as a stationary state, essentially, the Gibbs measure, and therefore they also inherit all the traps that are associated to this Gibbs measure, right? Okay, good. Now, it's perfectly true that there exist algorithms that do work. You mentioned some algorithms, I can mention some work that we have done just because I remember it, and in fact there are algorithms that work. So now we are facing a strange situation, which on the one hand we have a scenario which it's kind of hard to optimize, and yet we have algorithms that work efficiently. So we are missing something, that's the point. So this is not the end of the story. So this is these are the solutions which dominate the Gibbs measure, They are very numerous. There's an exponential number of such solutions, but there exist other types of solutions which are missed from the classical analysis in statistical mechanics, which are those that are found by algorithms. That's the key point. So how to do this? Well, the idea is the following, that we want to change, now to introduce a large deviation measure, to study something different. So what we want to study now is not only whether you have solution that perfect, so configuration of the Ws that perfectly store the patterns, but we want to ask the following question. I want to find if there exist regions, extensive regions of order n, that contain an exponential number of solutions that are nearby. Is that clear? So we have this, imagine that you have this landscape in, like a golf course. That's the kind of thing that I've just described. And on top of that, you have all the local minima. But then I want to see if there exists a lake somewhere which is very dense in solution, which is, you know, kind of, which is a, from the point of view of which is rare from a probabilistic perspective, because the number of solutions that are contained in this region can be exponentially smaller compared to the other solution, but still it exists. It exists. Okay, so in order to do this, let me introduce this number, which is the number of solutions to the learning problem that are within a distance, say d, with respect to a given configuration. So now I have a vector of w's, and I ask myself, well, I want to move this vector and see if I can find a region in which this vector is surrounded by the exponential number of ground states within a certain distance d. Is that clear? So I'm looking for a hypersphere which is dense. Now, if I do this, in order to study this problem, what I can do is just, well, I expect this number to be exponential, so I can define a new energy, which is the log of this quantity. And this is nothing but a local entropy, right? You agree with me? Because it's an entropy bounded within a certain distance, bounded by a distance, okay? So it's the entropy inside a certain region. So it depends on a parameter, which is the distance, the radius of this hypersphere. And I can consider this as a new statistical physics problem. I want to study if there exists W's that maximize this quantity. So I can study this as a new problem in statistical mechanics. I want to study the Boltzmann weight of this problem, and we're now introduce a fictitious temperature Y, and I want to take Y to infinity in order to find the ground state of this entropy. Is it clear? So I'm changing the measure. Now, if this is the case, if this scenario is all we have to say about this problem, now the function that I have introduced should be trivial. Because for small distances, this function should give just zero, right? Because we have, as I mentioned to you, you can show that for any alpha, there's a minimum distance between typical solution, which means that if you go below this distance, you find zero, okay? Now, if you do now this calculation, so what is the role of this, by the way, of this distance? If you take d large, you're counting all solutions belonging at a given distance d from a reference vector, so you're considering wide region, and as you reduce d, you're focusing on smaller and smaller regions. So if you take, for example, an energy landscape that looks like this, where these are the ground states, and if you take d large, you compute the local entropy, you obtain a curve like this. You see the minimum, you get it around more or less here, which is kind of an average over all these minima, right? Kind of a barycenter of that. Now you can reduce d, and this curve is going to focus at the end of the day on this, on the widest flat minimum of this energy landscape. This is a true calculation on this one-dimensional model. Okay, so the idea is something similar going on in neural networks, okay? Now, you can do all the calculation on this new energy function, and I skip the details, but this is what you find. Okay, so for the classical problem in which we just want to compute the typical distance between the minimum distance between solutions, you have to look at these red lines, using the so-called Franz-Parisi method, and you find that this is distance and this is the entropy, so the log of the number of configurations. So you see that for typical solutions, there always exists a gap below which the entropy goes below zero. So you do not have a solution in this regime. So they are effectively isolated. But this is by picking up configuration from the Gibbs distribution. So this is the average with respect to the Gibbs distribution of the local entropy. If we now optimize over this W, this reference vector, so we are not any longer, we are not just picking up from the distribution, but we optimize over that, what we get are the blue curves. And indeed, so what this is telling us is that, you see, this curve corresponds to alpha equal 0.4, this 0.6, 0.7, and so on, and 0.83 is the maximum capacity. But let's focus on alpha equal 0.4, for instance. And you see that what this is telling us is that this is, for any distance, let's say this is the distance, you have, it exists a region that has, within that distance, a very high entropy. So these regions exist. Even though they're rare, they exist and they're very flat, okay? Look, how flat? Well, if you look at this dotted line here, this corresponds to alpha equals zero. So that's just the log of the binomial coefficient. So it's the maximum number of configuration you have at a given distance d. And you see that this curve essentially overlaps with the maximum number, so it's super flat. And even if you increase alpha, you see that when you go close to small distances and you zoom it, you get this curve. They, at a certain point, they all overlap with this binomial coefficient. So it means that at a certain point, they become very, very flat. Locally, but locally still on order n, okay? It's not order one, so on extensive regions. Okay, this is fine, and now to go back to your question, if you run, now what one could do is just run simulated annealing on this new function instead of the original cost function, and if you do this, it's just, you know, it works perfectly, it just goes down. This is a picture, it's not a real simulation, because, but the idea is that while simulated annealing gets stuck in this metastable states, this one, the entropy-driven simulated annealing goes down, and you can do a kind of an annealing also in the distance. Okay, now, the key point I would like to stress is that these are not results that are typical to the binary perception. They're very general, okay? So, now if we consider neural networks with continuous weights, we need to have something which is non-convex, so we need to consider multi-layer networks because the single perceptron is convex, so nothing can happen. And of course, when now we consider continuous weights, instead of talking about the local entropy, we have to talk about the volume of the minima because we are in continuous setting. So what I used to call a high local entropy region in the case of the binary perceptron now becomes a wide flat minima in the case of continuous weights. It's just a matter of language. And the idea is that is it possible to find Ws that are inside this wide flat minimum in a continuous space? Okay, is that clear? And so this calculation can be done, but let me just mention one thing in order to tell you how it's done for those of you who are like to do replica calculation. So I can rephrase the problem of computing the Boltzmann weight with this new energy function, which is the local entropy. I can write it like this. So I, first of all, I define a local free entropy. This is exactly the same definition I used before. If you take beta prime going to infinity, this is going to sum over all Ws of zero energy, which means that correctly classify the patterns, constrained to be a given distance from W. So this is just the same thing I wrote before. This is just the local entropy I wrote before. now, I can write, given this, I can write the last derivation partition function that I don't think I can make it in there. Anyhow, in this form here, this is the entropic term and this will be the energetic term. And again, taking beta to infinity and beta prime to infinity, you recover the previous result. And so now if you write it explicitly, you get this expression. And you see what is nice about this is that essentially, if you take now the effective temperature to be integer, you get that if you take a model which is composed of y replicas of the original system with an external constraint that this replica should be at a given mutual Hamming distance, this measure naturally focuses on wide flat minima. Okay? That's the idea. And this is actually an algorithmic tool. So this is the idea, you impose this, you have many replicas and they are forced to be at a given distance from a reference configuration. And let me just mention that one can, instead of imposing this constraint, one can impose the mutual distance between replicas. It's a technicality, but this is a useful technicality because then one can use all the formalism of the replica calculation in order to derive these results on rare events. Essentially, one can use the Q1 order parameter as a control parameter and M of Parisi M plays the role of the number of replicas, but this is only for those of you who are expert in this kind of calculation. And this is the result. So this is k equal 3. And here is not the distance, but is the overlap. It's very similar. So it's the complement of the distance. So overlap equal 1 means short distances. And you see that for small distances, the volume around a minimum is equal to the maximum possible volume you get for that given distance. So the volume for a given alpha divided by the volume that you will get at alpha equals 0 essentially tends to 1, so the logs tend to 0. So when this curve becomes flat, it means that you have ended up in a flat minimum. I hope this is clear. And this solution are not described by the typical statistical mechanics calculations, right? So you don't see this contribution to the energy landscape. So the conclusion here is that this wide flat minima exists for random patterns. There's nothing to generalize here. It's a structural property of the network, okay? So let me skip all the algorithmic applications and so on. One thing that should be said is that on this replicated system, one can write the cavity equations, and then from them one can derive algorithms that are very effective in finding solutions. And in fact, they do find solutions that end up in this wide flat minimum. Or what you can do is you run a stochastic gradient on the replicated system. So this suggests a lot of algorithms that actually end up there. And this is a nice example in which, by the cavity method, we compute what is the volume around different type of solutions. Okay, so the purple one is an isolated, is a typical solution. Okay, this curve here, so this is distance and this is the normalized volume. This is the volume you observe obtained by a certain algorithm, which is suboptimal, let's say. And this is the solution you get using this belief propagation, this cavity algorithm that focuses on this wide flat minima. And indeed you find that you can find solutions that are extremely flat. So they exist, they are objects that are found and used. So this is also nice. This is the spectrum of the action. Look at this range of the variables. You see, this is the spectrum of the action found by different algorithms on this kind of architecture. And you see that, you know, this is a log scale. So this is why they look so flat, it's a log scale. But you see that the range is enormous. And this is the solution found by these local entropy-driven algorithms. So they are essentially super flat, right? It's extremely small, the range of variability of the... So if you don't take a log scale here, you just looks like a delta peak, okay, in zero. So it's extremely flat, whereas all the others have large eigenvalues. So 1 minute left. So one thing I want to say is that if you change slightly the model, and you take as an output unit, not a threshold inner function, but a parity check, for instance, which is a perfectly plausible device to do classification. You can do all the calculations using this measure and show that these wide flat minima do not exist. So let me say that neurons are special, okay, in this respect. So they are naturally, they allow for the existence of this wide flat minima. It's a structural property. Yes? So if you take, as a neural network now, you change the output node, and you take as an output node the product, like a p-spin node, then this does not, in the ground state, does not display any wide flat minimum. Okay? So let me just conclude by saying that, going back to this tutorial, please just give me 3 minutes more, and I'll shorten the no question at the end. I asked you, why did you choose the cross entropy? You agree with me that there's no reason a priori to choose a cross entropy in a deterministic system, right? But here is the argument. So people use cross entropy as, you know, as a loss function, and the cross entropy corresponds to the fact that you look at the output, and rather than interpreting the output as a real output, you interpret the output as a probability of the output, okay? Which is totally artificial. It's like you look at the output and you flip a coin. I mean, it's not, but the idea is that using this function instead of the error function, essentially you penalize, so this is the, okay, on this axis here is the input to the output node, so the pre-activation of the output node, and on the right it means that you are, the output is correct, on the left the sign is wrong, so the output is incorrect, And what this error function, this loss function is doing is to penalize configuration that are correct, but have a small robustness, so close to the boundary. Okay, this is what this cross-entropy function is doing. Now, what you can do is to, for instance, for the binary perceptor, but you can do it also for the other networks, you can compute, again, the phase diagram using the cross-entropy as a cost function, and what you get is that in the ground states, the ground state of the cross-entropy indeed corresponds to zero errors, but the question is, which type of solution do the cross-entropy find? So the ground state of the cross-entropy, do that correspond to the cross-entropy of the error cost function? The answer is no, not at all. And again, I have to skip this, unfortunately. It's the Parisi-France calculation, but this is the results. So what comes out is that the ground state of the cross-entropy are surrounded by an exponential number of ground state of solution of the error cost function, which means that the cross-entropy is focused, converges on the rare events of the Gibbs measure of the classical error function. So you see, this tiny change has completely changed the landscape. We have thrown away everything, and what remains are configurations that are the rare events of the original. And I think this is what is going on with the algorithm, okay? So I conclude by saying the fact that I didn't have time to not even explain what I've said, but doesn't matter. I didn't have time to discuss how wideness of the minima correlates with the generalization, and for this we have some analytical calculations and a lot of numerics. We have some results that shows us that using ReLU activation function instead of threshold also increases the local entropy, so it's a way of helping algorithm to converge. And this is something that Enrico Malatesta has been doing. And also we have results about the fact that if you use a stochastic process for learning that doesn't use a thermal noise, so it doesn't converge to the Gibbs measure, like saying you take the weights which are stochastic, or you use a quantum annealing scheme in which the fluctuation, again, are not of thermal type, they are naturally attracted by this wide flat minima, which makes a lot of sense because they are, you know, they have a very high entropy. So the conclusion is that this wide flat minima exists in discrete and continuous networks for random patterns, that some of the features that characterize the evolution of neural network, like the loss function, like the transfer function, amplify the contribution from these regions. And we suspect that also all the other essential many features essentially have the same role. Even the dropout is very similar to using stochastic weights. So the idea more or less is that you start with a very complex system, and then all these modifications are being added so that to turn the landscape into something which is much simpler. And the problem is that if you observe just the final results, it's difficult to go back and understand what is actually going on. Okay.
Thank you.
Sorry for.
Okay, so first, Jan.
This picture of wide flat minima and models that you consider, could you remind me whether it corresponds basically to one, it looks like the formula, some of the formula they showed, correspond to one step of replica symmetry. No, it's full?
No. These are, in one step replica symmetry baking, if it is that, the solution, you typically have an exponential number of extensive regions, right? And so the Gibbs measure is distributed among these different regions. These are a sub-exponential number of very dense regions, and they are not self-consistent, so they are not, you cannot find them from the replica calculation by optimizing over all the parameters.
But you show that using this M parameter as a...
It's a formal connection in which you have to use Q, this is for expert only, use Q1 and M as control parameters.
Okay.
They are not fixed set consistently.
Yeah, so that was very nice. I hadn't seen it before, and I think we have some complementary results. I'm sorry, we didn't reference this because I didn't know about it. So we have continuous degrees of freedom and calculated a partition function using the analog of a vibrational partition function with the Hessian eigenvalues. And there, when you scan the heat capacity as a function of the fictitious temperature, the high entropy minima show up as big peaks in the heat capacity at higher temperatures. So you get multiple peaks in the heat capacity, and you can assign them to these individual minima. So it's very different from a molecular system where that would be a floppy degree of freedom, and you tend to get a melting transition from that. This was very different. We actually found peaks that were entirely driven by a single minimum in the landscape at higher temperature for various different problems of neural networks. So we've definitely seen the same thing in a slightly different way, but it was just the harmonic vibrational partition function from the product of Hessian eigenvalues. So what you had.
Yeah, the
one more step.
Yeah, that's perfectly consistent. I should look at your paper, sorry if I didn't mention them, but the difference here is that when we obtain this, the Hessian, which is concentrated around zero, so very, very, we never compute the Hessian, okay? So this is obtained by trying to minimize the entropy. And so we are trying to minimize something on an extensive range. So I'm not sure that by optimizing directly the Hessian, you probably get some other type of traps that you don't get here.
We don't get the wide minima directly from global optimization at zero temperature.
Okay.
We get them when we expand the kinetic transition network. So you start from the bottom and explore the whole landscape. And as you go up, you find some of these minima that way. So we found them coincidentally, mm-hmm. Because they're not at the bottom for t equals naught, of course, as
okay.
we said. Yeah.
Thank you.
So I was wondering, following up on the Hessian, I was wondering in that graph, where was that evaluated? It sounds like it wasn't really evaluated anywhere.
Yeah, that was evaluated, okay. For that network, the critical capacity for k equal 3, the critical capacity is alpha equal 3, and the value of alpha above which you have breaking of replica symmetry, meaning that the space of solution breaks into many components, is alpha equal 1.76. That was evaluated alpha equal 2. But the same result also applies to below this replica symmetry breaking transition. So these states exist also in the replica symmetric phase.
I guess I meant more where in the landscape, like configuration-wise, it was evaluated.
Oh, you find the ground state? You find the ground state with, those pictures correspond to different type of algorithms. The algorithm give you a solution. Then around this solution, using the mean square error loss function or even the cross entropy, it doesn't matter, you compute the Hessian and the eigenvalues. And you know, for deep one, the one that gives a flat region is the locally entropy driven algorithm.
Other questions?
So I have two questions. One, can you say a bit more about the relationship between generalization and wide flat minima? This has been discussed a lot in the literature, so what's your take on this?
I'm not sure I can say something more than what is we have a calculation which we use a teacher-student scenario, but the problem with teacher-student scenario, as he was mentioning before, is that you have a strong prior, right? You use a network and you learn with a network is equal to the original teacher, so you're giving a lot of information to your students. You're telling him, look, I'm just like the teacher. So that's so what we did is to use as a generator a correlated parity machine, which is definitely different, and try to learn that with the network. So these are, you don't have the effect of this strong prior, and in that case you can show analytically by computing using the cavity method, you can show that the generalization error it's much better in the case in which you use the wide flat minima. So that's, I wouldn't call that an explanation, it's just a calculation, okay? Then you have a lot of numerics. Now, it's related to the number of effective degrees of freedom you have in a wide flat minima, clearly. No? In a wide flat minima, the effective number of degrees of freedom is not n, it's much smaller, because you have a lot of flat directions, so probably this also reconciles with the problem of the diverging number of parameters, because the effective number of parameters, it's actually much smaller than n. So the idea, more or less, is that when you optimize, you're actually doing this, you're also maximizing the local entropy, and that's something that's going to reduce the effective number of degrees of freedom. So this is why you can go to large n and still have things that work. This is intuition, I'm not It's not a theory. Okay.
And yeah, the second question is, so if I understand correctly, so what you say is that when you increase n the number of parameter, if you use the loss function, which is the cross entropy, actually you find things easily that you cannot find if you use the mean square loss, for example.
Yes.
But then at the same time, I mean, if n becomes very large, there are some many results that say that the landscape will become easy at the end.
It's small alpha, you mean?
Small alpha, yeah, exactly.
But okay, so, but even at small alpha, it's not true that all the minima are the same. Even at small alpha, you can have dense regions and sparse regions, and the dense regions are the good one for generalization. That's the main point. So even at small alpha, where it's under constraint, it's not, you still want to do something like this. You still want to find a dense region solution just because you want to be, you know, on a Bayesian kind of argument, you want to be close to many other models that predict, make the same prediction.
Okay, so even in that case in which the landscape is, in a certain sense, easy, finding the good region is difficult if you use.
No, I'm not saying it's difficult. I'm just saying it's useful.
No, I mean, if you use mean square loss, you're saying it's difficult, right?
No, for small alpha, it's not difficult. But what I'm saying is that it's not true that all the algorithms give the same result at small alpha.
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, to find the one that generalizes
well. Ah, yes, yes. Yeah. It's not non-trivial. I'm not saying it's difficult, because I wouldn't say that.
So, just one last quick question.
Okay. So I'm just still trying to wrap my head around this, but just two aspects I want to ask about how crucial they are or whether they can be, the result can be extended. One is more concrete, which is, in your networks, you don't have the all each, if I understand correctly, there's no sharing in the sense that each hidden unit is connected to different inputs.
Oh yeah,
is that a crucial aspect, or is that just
To avoid the permutation symmetry, just for an analytic purpose.
Okay.
It's just to avoid the permutation symmetry of the hidden unit, but.
So we expect the same behavior.
No, yeah, with the cavity method, we can also deal with the case of fully connected. So it's.
In the second, especially for the teacher situation, if I understand correctly, you're taking the inputs to be uniformly taken uniformly at random. Is that how crucial?
The teacher-student scenario?
In the teacher-student scenario, the labels are generated by the network.
Yes.
But the X's, I think you call them, the inputs you're taking is uniformly random, if I understood correctly. Maybe I missed that.
I didn't show anything. I mean, okay. What we did is just, because the problem is you can do a teacher-student calculation which you generate the data with a given network and you're trying to learn it.
But how do you, the network only generates the outputs.
A random network.
So the network only generates the outputs. How do you generate the inputs?
Uniformly at random.
Okay, so how crucial is that?
I don't know. Okay, that's the answer. I mean, we just generated them uniformly at random, and then you can see that this algorithm generalizes much better than the typical solutions. That's why, Giulio, even the teacher-student, you observe this. Yeah. However, the problem with the teacher-student scenario in that context is that you have a strong prior on the architecture of the teacher, and therefore it's not a very general result. So we change this and we consider a teacher which is not correlated, let's say, with the student.
Okay, so let's stop here with this. Thanks, Riccardo, for